Imagine spending like 20 years meticulously building your wealth.
Right, maxing out all your accounts, optimizing
Yeah,
everything.
doing everything right, only for a single local election or a sudden dip in your country's currency to just wipe out a quarter of your purchasing power overnight.
It is brutal,
Yeah.
but that is the reality of geographic concentration risk.
Exactly. We spend so much time diversifying across different asset classes, right? Like stocks, bonds, whatever.
Oh, for sure.
But when it comes to where that money actually sits, geographically, most of us are doing the financial equivalent of keeping all our eggs in one very specific, very localized basket.
We really do. We just default to the country we were born in.
Right. Or the one we happen to live in right now. And
Yeah.
in today's rapidly shifting global landscape, that is just a massive blind spot.
It's a huge blind spot. I mean, it creates a really profound structural vulnerability. When your domestic market takes a hit, or say your central bank makes a misstep.
Which happens all the time.
Right, exactly. When that happens, your entire portfolio suffers simultaneously because it all shares the exact same macroeconomic foundation.
Yeah, the floor just falls out from under you.
Yeah.
And that vulnerability is exactly why today we are taking you on a custom-tailored deep dive to look beyond those borders.
It's an important conversation.
Welcome, everyone. Our mission today is to figure out how to successfully, expand your financial footprint across the globe.
Yeah.
We're going to decode the mechanics of foreign markets.
And crucially, discover how to dodge the hidden traps of international investing.
Yes, the traps.
Yeah.
Because there are a lot of them. We are anchoring our conversation today in the frameworks from a really fascinating source, excerpts from Global Horizons, a strategic guide to international investing.
It's a great read. And looking at a heat map of global growth right now, based on this source, the core theme of the strategy becomes very, very clear.
Oh.
We are navigating this really delicate, sometimes precarious balance between international risk and international opportunity. It's really about understanding the mechanics of how money behaves completely differently the second it crosses a border.
Okay, let's unpack this because before we can even talk about like what vehicles you should be using to invest, you need to know where to even look.
Right, the where comes before the what.
Exactly. And a major premise in the source material here is that chasing the absolute highest yield in a vacuum is just a rookie mistake.
Oh, absolutely. A 20% return in a highly volatile market is usually a mirage.
It's totally a mirage.
Yeah.
Picking a foreign market to allocate your capital is a lot like picking a new city to relocate your family to, right?
That's a really good way to look at it.
You wouldn't just look at the salary a new job is offering, which in this case is your gross return.
No, you'd check the local crime rate.
Right. Which translates to political and economic stability in the financial world. You evaluate the cost of living, which mirrors currency risk.
And you definitely want to know if the local infrastructure actually supports outsiders.
Yes,
Yeah.
exactly. Which is your market access and regulatory frameworks. You don't want to move somewhere that actively makes it hard for you to live there.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, stability isn't just some conservative safety net. It is the fundamental baseline that allows the math of compound growth to actually function.
Say more about that because I think people gloss over stability.
Well, I mean, if you deploy capital into a highly volatile region, yeah, you might see that 20% return on paper, but consider the underlying mechanics.
Okay.
If a sudden political upheaval causes, say, local inflation to spike by 15%,
Ricks.
right, or their central bank devalues the currency by 25% against your home currency, your real-world return is severely negative.
The purchasing power of that capital has just completely evaporated.
Exactly. This is why markets with ironclad legal systems and steady governance, specifically the source highlights the United States, Germany, and Singapore, they're highlighted as foundational destinations.
Because they provide a predictable baseline.
Right. A place where a contract is actually a contract.
That currency drag mechanic is something that catches so many investors off guard. Investing in regions with weak or, actively depreciating currencies systematically destroys your returns the second you initiate the conversion back to your base currency.
It acts as a silent tax. The underlying asset could perform beautifully, but the exchange rate just kills it.
It completely kills it.
Yeah.
This is why heavy allocations tend to gravitate toward regions operating on stable fiat, like the euro, the US dollar, or the Swiss franc.
And beyond currency, you're also looking at sector concentration. Certain geographies just have deep structural advantages.
Right, like one region might have the regulatory environment to be a powerhouse for green energy.
Exactly. While another region has the demographic tailwinds to completely dominate in commercial real estate.
And we have to acknowledge that not every market actively wants foreign retail capital, right?
Oh, definitely not. Some jurisdictions impose punitive taxation on non-resident investors just to prevent local asset bubbles.
Or they restrict direct investment in strategic sectors entirely.
Which is why, as we said, the jurisdiction dictates the rules of engagement. The where always precedes the what.
Okay, so let's assume you've identified a stable jurisdiction, you've evaluated the governance, you've hedged the currency.
You've done your homework.
Exactly. Now we pivot to building the actual asset mix within those borders.
Mm.
And according to Global Horizons, we are looking at four primary vehicles.
Right, let's break those down. First up, equities and ETFs.
Yeah, the standard mechanisms for capturing broad economic growth in established markets. Second is real estate.
Specifically targeting income and capital appreciation in markets with high population influx, like Dubai or mature commercial sectors in the UK.
Third, bonds, functioning essentially as your volatility anchor.
And fourth, alternative assets. This encompasses REITs, private equity, and tokenized or fractional real estate.
The bond market dynamic here is particularly interesting to me.
It really is instructive. I mean, developed market sovereign bonds offer lower yields because you are paying a premium for systemic safety.
Right. You're paying for the peace of mind.
Exactly. Whereas emerging market debt offers significantly higher yields, but, you know, you are being compensated for taking on default risk and extreme currency volatility.
So the spread between those two yields is essentially the market pricing in the probability of a crisis.
That's exactly it.
But wait, I have to push back on the real estate allocation here.
Okay, go for it.
If international ETFs offer such an incredibly frictionless way to get broad stroke exposure to a country's economic output, why should an everyday investor take on the massive complicated headache of trying to acquire physical property in a place like London or Dubai?
It is a lot of work, I'll give you that.
I mean, dealing with foreign property management, local tenant laws, physical maintenance, it sounds totally archaic compared to just executing a trade on a brokerage app on your phone.
The administrative burden is real. Absolutely. And historically, it kept retail investors entirely out of cross-border property.
Right. It was just too hard.
But physical real estate serves a distinct mechanical function in a portfolio that equities simply cannot replicate.
Okay. How so?
Well, a stock's valuation is highly elastic, right? It can plummet overnight based on a shift in algorithmic trading or just a poor quarterly guidance call.
Sure. Happens all the time.
But a commercial building in London or a residential block in Dubai has intrinsic, tangible value. It provides a non-correlated, predictable income stream through rent.
Oh, I see. So it acts as a shock absorber during equity market sell-offs.
Precisely. The barrier has always been access and management, which is exactly why the financial infrastructure is shifting toward fractional ownership and alternative asset platforms today.
They allow you to capture that tangible shock absorber without having to, like, fly to London to negotiate with a roofing contractor.
Exactly. You get the stability without the headache.
Tangible stability versus paper elasticity. That is a really vital distinction. So let's take those asset classes and map them onto the actual macroeconomic landscape we're looking at.
Yeah, the projections for 2025 in the source are fascinating.
They divide the global hotspots into established heavyweights and fast movers.
Hmm.
Let's look at the heavyweights first.
The United States obviously remains the ultimate global tech hub.
Oh, incredibly deep, liquid financial markets.
Yeah.
But the source points out the structural risks there are heavy exposure to dollar fluctuations and really complex capital gains taxes for non-residents.
Right. And then you have Germany, highly stable economy, heavily subsidizing the green energy transition, very resilient industrial property sector.
But the trade-off there is a structurally slower growth rate and a high taxation environment.
The heavyweights operate on a very, very predictable risk-reward curve. You are granted deep liquidity, meaning you can enter and exit massive positions without moving the market.
And strong property rights.
Yes. But you pay a premium for that safety via lower explosive growth potential and much heavier regulatory burdens.
Now, here's where it gets really interesting. Because the real gravity seems to be shifting toward the fast movers.
The emerging markets.
Yeah. You have the UAE boasting incredibly investor-friendly tax frameworks and a massive influx of expatriate wealth driving property demand.
Though the systemic risk there is the potential for market saturation, you know, short-term real estate oversupply.
Right. Then there's India, rapidly expanding economy, booming domestic tech sector, massive rising middle class.
Yet, to access it, you're navigating these Byzantine bureaucratic structures and historical currency volatility.
But the contrast that truly illustrates these global dynamics is between Vietnam and Saudi Arabia.
Oh, absolutely. The source highlights this so well.
Vietnam is rapidly absorbing global supply chains, right? As this low labor cost, export-driven alternative to China.
Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia is engineering a massive structural pivot with Vision 2030, just pouring sovereign capital into entirely new infrastructure and highly regulated investment platforms.
What's fascinating here is the causality behind these profiles. Mm. Every single advantage in these emerging hotspots is intrinsically linked to its corresponding risk.
It really is. Like, take Vietnam. It offers incredible manufacturing growth because foreign direct investment is pouring into factories.
But that industrial growth is vastly outpacing their domestic financial infrastructure.
Exactly, which creates severe liquidity concerns. It is super easy to build a factory, but it is really hard to cash out a massive equity position quickly on an immature stock exchange.
And looking at Saudi Arabia, the sheer scale of the Vision 2030 giga projects offers ground floor access to infrastructure that simply doesn't exist in legacy markets.
Right, it's unprecedented.
But because the market is still maturing and heavily tethered to state sponsors' initiatives, you face limited diversification compared to a mature market like the U.S.
Building a resilient portfolio requires intentionally balancing the slow, predictable compounding of, say, a German industrial ETF with the high-ceiling structural transitions happening in India or the Gulf.
It requires an impartial assessment of macroeconomic reality.
Because getting the return on paper in these booming markets is only the first phase. The moment you attempt to actually realize those gains, you hit the defensive perimeter of international finance.
Which brings us to the most dangerous part of this strategy. The fine print.
The red tape.
Yes, because a 30% return in a high-growth market is entirely useless if the capital gets trapped or if it's taxed into oblivion before it even reaches your domestic account.
The defensive strategy of international investing is all about protecting the net return.
Right, because far too many investors model their wealth projections on gross returns and completely ignore the friction of cross-border capital movement.
This is a very common mistake.
We are looking at three major structural hurdles here based on the text. First, taxation.
The big one. We're talking withholding taxes on dividends, property income, capital gains.
And the absolute most critical step is verifying if your home country has a double taxation agreement, or DTA, with the destination country.
Because without a DTA, the math is just brutal.
It really is. You might get hit with a 20% withholding tax by the foreign government at the source, and then face another 20% capital gains tax from your home government when you try to repatriate the funds.
You are effectively paying for the infrastructure of two different nations at that point.
The DTA is the legal mechanism that prevents that dual bleed. It dictates which country has the primary right to tax, or it allows you to claim foreign tax credits.
Which is huge. And then the second hurdle is repatriation and capital controls.
We discussed currency volatility earlier, but the actual physical mechanics of moving money across borders can be shocking to retail investors.
Oh, it really can. Certain developing nations actively limit, delay, or heavily tax the transfer of earnings out of their banking system.
The source materials analogy for this is perfect. Reminds me of going to buy tokens at an arcade.
Oh yeah, the arcade analogy.
You walk in and the machine happily converts your cash into proprietary arcade tokens all day long, instantly.
Very
easy. But when you are ready to leave, you discover the arcade has a strict policy against converting those tokens back into cash. You're just stuck with them.
And to take that arcade analogy a step further, sometimes the arcade will let you cash out, but only a few tokens at a time.
Wow, so trapping your wealth inside their walls for years.
Exactly. Countries implement these capital controls to protect their foreign exchange reserves, usually to prevent massive capital flight during economic downturns.
But for a foreign investor, having your liquidity frozen by a central bank decree is catastrophic.
It's a nightmare scenario.
And the third major hurdle involves foreign ownership rules.
Right. In many jurisdictions, non-citizens are literally legally barred from holding direct titles to land.
So you are forced to utilize government-approved local agencies or set up complex corporate structures, which just drastically increases your regulatory overhead and your legal fees.
Navigating these frameworks like auditing DTAs, modeling repatriation limits, and structuring ownership entities, none of this provides the dopamine hit of selecting a high-growth tech stock.
No, it's definitely not the sexy part of investing.
But this unglamorous, highly technical due diligence is precisely what prevents a theoretically brilliant investment from devolving into a grueling, multi-year lesson in international tax law.
I can imagine anyone listening right now feeling the weight of that administrative friction. The DTAs, the capital controls, the localized legal entities. I mean, it sounds like a full-time job.
It historically has been a full-time job.
But the financial ecosystem recognizes this bottleneck. The Source details how we are seeing a massive evolution in platforms designed specifically to abstract away this logistical nightmare.
It's the technological bridge erasing these borders for the individual investor.
Yeah, it's the democratization of institutional-grade infrastructure.
A prime example of this evolution that the book dives into is a digital investment platform called Usul Gamma.
Right, Usul Gamma. Their architecture is built to make global investing accessible by offering fractional, asset-backed opportunities in cross-border real estate.
And what caught my eye isn't just the fractional aspect, it's the barrier to entry.
They have lowered the minimum investment to $500 US, or 500 Saudi riyals.
Which is wild. That fundamentally changes the demographic of who can participate in global real estate.
Mechanically, the text notes they're fully Sharia compliant, meaning the underlying investments avoid interest-bearing leverage, or RIBA, and operate on asset-backed profit sharing.
And crucially, they are regulated by the CMA.
Yes, the Capital Market Authority in Saudi Arabia. That means they are subjected to incredibly strict government audits regarding transparency, custody of assets, and operational compliance.
The platform is engineered to solve the exact cross-border rules and repatriation concerns we just outlined.
Specifically tailored for investors in the Gulf who want compliant access to the US, the EU, or broader GCC markets.
They're essentially prepackaging the legal entities, the tax compliance, and the property management into a digital interface.
Okay, so what does this all mean for you listening? I have to pose a critical question here.
Let's hear it.
By lowering the barrier to entry to just $500 and wrapping it in a sleek app, do platforms like Usul Gamma actually protect you from the macroeconomic risks we analyzed, like a sudden currency devaluation or a regional
And
recession?
that's the million-dollar question.
Right. Or do they simply make it frictionless to get a seat at a table that is still fundamentally volatile?
This raises an important point, and the distinction here is probably the most vital takeaway of this entire analysis.
Okay.
No platform, regardless of its technological sophistication or its regulatory oversight by the CMA, can eliminate macroeconomic
It
risk.
just can't be done.
Right. If you utilize a fractional platform to acquire a stake in a commercial logistics hub in the US, and the US dollar suddenly depreciates against your local currency, the purchasing power of your return will still drop.
If the U.S. commercial real estate market experiences a downturn, your asset value will decline.
Exactly. The underlying market realities absolutely remain.
So what exactly is the investor paying for when they use these platforms?
You are paying for the total elimination of administrative friction. The platform's true value is providing a legal and logistical shield.
They absorb the bureaucracy of foreign property rights.
They bypass the exorbitant international legal retainers, and they natively handle those double taxation agreements we talked about.
They ensure the compliance frameworks are airtight so your capital never gets trapped in that arcade.
Exactly. It grants you the ability to construct a heavily diversified, income-generating portfolio of global hard assets without needing to personally incorporate a holding company in three different time zones.
You gain the global exposure cleanly and legally, but the onus of choosing the right geographic market still rests entirely on you.
You remove the friction, but you cannot remove the fundamental economic reality.
That is a brilliant synthesis. We have covered an immense amount of technical ground today. Let's quickly recap the architecture of this deep dive for you.
We started with the where.
Right. The critical necessity of prioritizing political stability and fiat strength to protect the mathematics of compound growth.
Then we analyzed the what. We contrasted the broad liquidity of international equities against the non-correlated tangible income of physical real estate.
We mapped out the 2025 landscape, weighing the deep liquidity and heavy taxes of established heavyweights like the US and Germany against the structural transformations and liquidity risks of fast movers like India, Vietnam, and Saudi Arabia.
We dissected the defensive strategies required to survive double taxation, capital controls, and foreign ownership restrictions.
And finally, we explored how CMA-regulated fractional platforms like Usul Gamma are technologically bypassing that red tape, allowing you to deploy capital globally for as little as $500.
It really represents a structural shift in how retail capital flows across the globe.
It really does.
And, you know, it leaves me pondering one final implication from all of this.
What's that?
If digital fractional platforms continue to seamlessly dissolve the administrative borders of investing, allowing anyone, anywhere, to hold micro stakes in global infrastructure, do we eventually reach an inflection point where the concept of a strictly local economy just ceases to exist?
Oh, wow.
Think about it. If the retirement security of an individual in Riyadh is intrinsically tethered to the commercial real estate yields in London and the green energy output in Berlin, our collective economic fate becomes entirely intertwined.
The frictionless border might just create a truly shared global consequence.
Exactly.
A completely borderless financial future, where local downturns are absorbed by global portfolios. That is a fascinating thought to leave on.
It changes everything.
To you listening, thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Remember, relying solely on the economy of your zip code is an unnecessary risk in a connected world.
Do your due diligence out there.
Keep exploring those global horizons, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.